The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Good morning. On the day after tax day, we're impressed you actually showed up, Rich.
I am too.
We're glad you're here. Yes, tax day lives.
We are really, really glad to have made it past that again. So,
you know, I have a CPA here in my office building, and no matter how early or late I stay at night or come in the morning, he's always here. I suspect him of having a cot somewhere in the back that he just lives here for a couple of weeks before tax day.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, man. It's I know I put in some pretty long hours. It's I keep telling my wife after doing this for 30 years, you'd think I'd figure this out so I don't have to do this. And I have really great people at work for me, but in the end, it comes down to lots of guesstimates and figuring out how we're going to extend people, and there's just a lot to do. So,
you know, I married the daughter of a tax man. I remember in the old days, it was the midnight run to the post office with a box full of tax returns, trying to catch it at the last minute, get it postmarked on time. I guess with e-filing, it's all changed now.
Well, it's interesting because even on the e-filing, I notice that the tax software that – and there's lots of tax software out there that you can use, obviously. But every year I notice that a number of them have, you know, server overload issues or something, and people can't – you know, are trying to file, but they can't. And so even yesterday, you know, there were requests into the IRS. So even today – for a lot of people that are electronically filing, it still works if you do it today because, you know, the IRS had their issues and a lot of the tax software companies that have servers that feed into the IRS had problems. So anyway, in some ways, maybe it's even easier than the old run to the post office thing.
So, yeah. Well, the pipeline's only so big and you can only stuff so many things through it at a time. So
yeah, so it's pretty crazy.
Well, we have some interesting news in view of our tax season here. It's one of the ones that has struck me is what's been going on with gold. It's seen its biggest one-day drop, actually two days of drop history in the past 30 years. It's down a little more than 9%, 9.4% to roughly $1,300 and some change an ounce.
So that's down in 2 days?
There were two different days when it had big, huge drops, but it's just been the bottom's just been kicked out. There's rumors on the internet that I've read that it's China dumping gold, that investors are spooked. They blamed it on how well the stock market's doing, but another interesting thing is the stock market has had its worst one-day drop in 2013, this last week. So it was down 250 points up for the Dow. So I don't know. They're blaming gold on how strong the stock market is, but it's doing badly too. I guess maybe some of the predictions of inflation haven't been as obvious as people thought they ought to be, although it's, I don't know if you're, it's hard not to see that food prices are up and a lot of other prices are up too, but.
So the gold is down how much this year?
Year to date, my understanding, the decline is 18.73%.
Wow.
That's what's reported. And, you know, we had that guest on a while ago that was the precious metals guru who was telling everybody they ought to invest in gold, that gold always goes up. But I think the market's been unkind to gold investors with the decline here. You know, another interesting thing, foreign holdings of U.S. debt is now at an all-time high, with foreign nations owning $5.7 trillion of U.S. debt. And, of course, China being the number one owner, and Japan is, I think, number two, which also surprised me to find out. But China's using all those U.S. dollars, of course, to invest in U.S. infrastructure. So the great communist nation of China has taken our dollars in two ways. They're buying U.S. debt. They're selling us cheap goods made with slave labor. And now the third way is they're buying U.S. infrastructure. So they're going to earn multiple dividends on U.S. productivity, which is kind of an interesting I think they call that irony, where supposedly the supposed freest and most productive economy in the world is going to be largely owned by one of the most repressive, rule-bound, centrally planned, unfree economies of the world. That's just an unpredictable, perverse outcome.
Oh, gosh. Well, a lot of scary things out there. So one other thing that it's in the news is, and this is always interesting to me as a tax guy, is if you add up all the money the government is spending, and this is all governments across the board, you know, federal, state, city, county, using, and this is information from the U.S. Census Bureau and the Office of Management and Budget. If you take that number and you divide it by the number of households in the United States, you get a figure that now exceeds the median amount of money those households collectively earn. So since 2010, the government has begun spending more money than it can even raise as revenue by taxing households, even if they were taxing them 100%. So
that old tax joke, the simplified tax form, how much did you make? Send it in.
If
all the governments were collecting 100% of our revenue, they're still spending more than we're all making. How much? Let's see. We have the numbers here. 5.94 trillion dollars of federal spending divided across 118 million households comes out to $50,074 per household as the median. Have I got that right, Rich?
Well, the median household income was 49.45, and they were spending 50,074, so it's a $629 difference. And that's the federal, state, municipal, you know, that amounted to the 5.94 trillion. So,
and that's spending, so that's not what they're collecting. So what they can't collect from taxes, they borrow or they print.
Right.
And only the feds can print. So the states and local city, county governments, they're having to borrow, I guess.
Right.
Bonds, sure. And other forms of borrowing. That, by the way, we should tell our listeners, they can learn more about that in a book called Completely Predictable, by the author Terrence Jeffrey. And that's such an interesting analysis. To kind of tells us the state of our the state of our nation, probably more telling than what the politicians will confess to.
Oh, you think? Well, and Tax Freedom Day in 2013, Rick, is, we haven't gotten there yet. So it's April 18th this year. So that's the day that collectively we earn enough to pay our income tax bills. We're not including all the other taxes. That's why what we've just been telling you doesn't make sense if it's Tax Freedom Day on April 18th. But this is just for our federal income taxes. So.
And it kind of flops around from year to year. I guess there have been some years it's been into May,
mm-hmm.
but it's been steadily growing worse for the last 4 or 5 years here.
Yeah, definitely, because it's directly tied to rates, and we saw those go up, and then it's, you know, they're closing all the incentive things, incentive depreciation, and so there's a lot of things that go into it, but every year it's a little bit different. But this year it's April 18th. So keep working out there.
Yeah, two more days of work to cover your hypothetical tax bill. But if only we could limit the spending of government to the actual tax revenue, that would be a novel idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, talk to us about this use tax that they have in California. I don't understand that. You were talking to me about it before
started. Well, actually, it's a use tax, and it's actually in every state. It's in Arizona, it's Utah. Pretty much every state has a use tax. And what a use tax is, so if you're in the state and you buy something, you pay sales tax. So especially with the internet these days, it didn't used to be as big of a problem, but if you buy something from out of state, you'll notice that most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, you don't pay sales tax, but you're supposed to pay use tax. And what use tax is just a substitute for the sales tax, and you're supposed to pay that in your home state. So what several states have gone to on this.
Okay, so several states have gone to this tax where they want you to fess up, confess to what you bought online, and pay a tax on it. And interestingly enough, you've had to – it's kind of self-report. And if you are honest, I guess, quote-unquote, you're going to acknowledge that, oh, I bought something. Well, a number of states, including California, one of the things we were talking about, have published some charts to help with calculating that use tax. And people relying on these charts have actually had their tax liability go down. Rich, have you rejoined us?
I have.
Okay, so talk to us about the stamp collector guy. I like that story.
So this is from, I read this in Forbes, but so there's a guy that collects stamps. So he buys them online, and he was one of these guys that thought, you know, he should be reporting those sales. And so he was actually paying up to like $3,000 a year in use tax. And the way you pay use tax, you're supposed to add it to your income tax return on your state income tax return. And he and now that they've published tables, you just go to the table and you figure out what your income level is, and then there's, you know, several things in there that affect your liability. But now he's looked it up in the chart. Now he owes like $56, and
because
it's based on the income, yeah. So. So anyway, I think what they're hoping is that, you know, a lot of people out there, because it isn't that much, that they'll just, you know, raise their hand and decide to pay it. And technically and legally, that's what you're supposed to do. But obviously, most people don't even think about it. So anyway, did you pay yours yesterday?
I've never... I frankly have somebody else prepare my tax returns, and then I ask them. This is the question I ask them: did I tell the truth, and am I honoring and obeying the law, and did I pay any more taxes than I absolutely have to? And if my tax preparer says you're fine on all those, then I sign the tax return and I send it in. I'm probably They tell me I'm still liable for it if there's mistaken information in there, but I don't know. I'm even as a lawyer, even as the son-in-law of a tax lawyer and a tax preparer, and all the tax work I do with my clients, they ask me these questions. I say, go. That's why you hire Rich Bloomfield or somebody like Rich Bloomfield to do the taxes. It's terribly intimidating. I think that, in fact, the tax code has become so complicated that without the software that y'all use, I don't know how anybody would actually calculate things. The alternative minimum tax formulas. Every time I've dived into that, looked at that, and tried to figure out how do they get to that number, I think without software, it would just be silly, ridiculous to try and calculate.
That's absolutely true, because you have to calculate regular tax and that tax and then choose which one is the highest. But anyway, which kind of leads us into the next section of our show, which is I wanted to spend some time, since yesterday was such a wonderful day, talking about a couple of kind of crazy things that we see out there. And you know, you get down to the 11th hour, and then you see things that are happening in people's tax returns. And so we probably have time to go over one of those maybe before we get to our first break, Rick. But here's the one thing that I think if our listeners out there could take this one to heart, I think it would benefit millions of people out there, actually. But what I think happens is that, you know, there's such a push, and has been such a push for years, for people to maximize their 401k or their, whichever kind of qualified plan they have in their business. And, you know, we work with lots and lots and lots and lots of business owners, as most of our listeners know. And so someone comes in and says, hey, you should do a qualified plan. Maybe they've had it in place for years, but they do all kinds of things to maximize contributions to that. You know, they make sure their income is high. They put their wife on the payroll. They put the kids on the payroll. You know, all of them start paying payroll taxes, and then they completely forget about the fact that, you know, hey, if we weren't contributing to these plans, you know, it's all our money anyway that's going in there. It's not like we have an employer that's contributing part. But in order to do this, we're paying more self-employment tax, the FICA, you know, the FICA taxes, all those taxes that happen, no matter whether you're paying income tax or not. And, in an S corp world, which most of our business owners are in, or even in the LLC world, you can pay a reasonable salary, and then the rest of it you can make as distributions, which are not subject to the self-employment tax. So I see this all the time, Rick, where people just, you know, it's not an insignificant number. It's a nice vacation. You know, it's eight or $10,000 sometimes that people pay more in self-employment tax than they really need to. And you know, your questions that you ask your tax guy, I mean, this isn't pushing any of those. I mean, you're still doing what you should be doing, but you don't have to do more. You don't have to pay more than you should, and that's what a lot of people are doing. And it's I think it's a lot of times because they get focused on, hey, I got to fund my qualified plan, which as our listeners probably know by now, we're not that crazy about, especially when you're funding the entire thing, because it's just probably is not going to work out well for you if you look at historically. But
well,
I know I get in trouble all the time by saying that, because people think that, I mean, if you have an employer and they're contributing 6%, yeah, you should take that. But
the incentives for employees and employers are opposing. what's good for employees and what's good for employers are not the same thing. And that's – so whether you ought to fund that or not depends on which one you are. Are you the employee or are you the employer? And most of our clients tend to be the employer. They're the business owner. They're the entrepreneur, and the incentives are just completely different if they really look at it. But it's that old English proverb, penny wise, pound foolish. I think we need to go to break. After we come back from break, we'll talk about a few more crazy things that people do that result in paying more taxes. And then we'll come back with some things that you can do to not mess up your children with money. We have some great ideas about that that we'll talk about when we come back from break in a few minutes.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
We spend 70% of our week in the office. What is the difference between enjoying your job and enduring it? The number one motivator is a positive work environment. And that's where Real Recognition Radio comes in. Join your hosts, Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown, as they take a look at the positive factors of the workplace, such as employee rewards, recognition, incentives, and much more. Tune in to Real Recognition Radio, Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, on the Voice America Business Channel.
We hear it and read about it every day in the news.
America is heading over a fiscal cliff. Home prices are still receding and unemployment growing.
How can you preserve and increase your wealth in this kind of economy? Tune in to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with host Jay Taylor. Jay will explain the decline of our monetary system and the economy and will give you winning investment ideas and the tools to protect and increase your wealth. Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor can be heard Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back, everyone. Just before the break, talking again about these things that end up costing people taxes. Rick, earlier you mentioned that how difficult it is to calculate tax liability now. I mean, I've done this long enough that I remember doing taxes without a computer. I mean, it was only a couple of years, but you know, they've just because you can do it with software now, then the politicians have made it more and more and more complicated. And I saw evidence of this yesterday, and I think one thing that happens to preparers, and you know, so this is why I think it's good for people to be asking questions, is sometimes you rely too much on the software and not enough on, you know, your knowledge of the tax law. For example, I was looking at a return yesterday, and you know, this was a client of mine that do a lot of work with, and it didn't make sense. I was looking at the, you know, at the tax return, at the regular tax and the alternative minimum tax. And you know that if you're paying alternative minimum tax, that, you know, usually there are some tax preference items that you have. So you kind of can zero in and say, okay, well, what is it that's causing this? And, you know, and you can usually say, oh, okay, I get it. Well, I wasn't getting it at all, and it just didn't make any sense. And this is a situation where we'd gotten some information late, and so we were trying to plug in depreciation and kind of override the depreciation with our own numbers, what we thought they were, because we didn't have the actual ones yet. And this is just for extending. We weren't filing, just lest anybody think we're making guesses on filing. And it turns out that the software was not, they just assumed since you were plugging it the regular depreciation that you didn't have any alternative minimum tax depreciation, and that causes a big problem when you go to calculate alternative minimum tax. So anyway, just a word to the wise out there. Be really careful, because the tax software shouldn't have done that, but it did, and sometimes you just have to really be watching and paying attention. And I know a lot of my clients have said, you know, I'm supposed to sign this return. I don't even have a clue of what's going on. And, you know, most of them are okay with that, but some of them aren't, and they want you to talk through it. So, and probably the last thing for me, Rick, as far as crazy things where I see people paying too much tax is, and I know I mentioned this last week, but I'm beginning to believe it's a huge problem out there, is that there are, it's called basis, and it's not something that we can really explain on the show here, but basically in an S-corp, the basis calculation is just kind of a lot different than it is if you're in a partnership or an LLC or something else. And it's more difficult to make sure that you have basis. If you don't have basis, it's like you don't have, you can't take losses. And if you take a distribution out of your S-corp and you don't have basis, then it becomes a capital gain to you. And here's my favorite one, and this is where I think a lot of people get nasty surprises, is that people out there who sell equipment, for example, if you're selling equipment to a doctor or to a dentist or, you know, to you know, a big computer system to a law firm or an accounting firm, and you, so people know that you get closer to the end of the year, then if you can expense this stuff, and you can under Section 179, and pretty much everybody out there knows what Section 179 is, where you can expense a certain amount of depreciation of equipment that you purchase. So these equipment people know that, and so they're out there at the end of the year saying, hey, you know, buy this, it'll reduce your tax liability. But of course they never ask, you know, do you have basis in your company to be able to do that? Because you also, if you don't have basis, you also don't get to take the Section 179 deduction, and that'll carry forward or something else, but that's a painful surprise for people. And they get to the end of the year and they haven't planned on writing a big tax bill because they just bought this big piece of equipment, spent all their money, or went into debt for it. And now, they don't have basis. So if you don't know what the basis is in your company, you should. And, that should be a question that you ask, your tax guy. And a lot of them, I notice, don't even track it. And so I've had several clients who've taken deductions that they weren't entitled to. We've had to go back and amend the returns, you know, costing them tens of thousands of dollars. So, and then right along with that, another thing that is that many states out there now, like state of Arizona, state of Arkansas, state of whatever, they limit the amount of Section 179 deduction that you can take in a year. So it's a different amount than the federal. So the federal might be okay with letting you expense $135,000 or whatever the number is. It changes all the time. But the state might say, oh, no, you can only take 25. And so there's where, you know, the value of somebody that's planning for you comes in, because you know, maybe you don't want to take Section 179 because maybe that isn't the right way to go if other depreciation would be deductible by the state. So you just have to look at your own situation. But that, I know, Rick, that's been a big surprise to lots and lots of people, is that they find out, oh, well, I did okay on federal, but now I have a pretty massive state tax bill to pay that I wasn't expecting.
You know, I have this voice in my head. I'm old enough I can remember an old sitcom from the 60s, Gomer Pyle. And I hear Gomer Pyle saying, "Surprise, surprise, surprise." It's not a happy thing.
No, it's not a happy surprise.
Not a happy one. Which kind of brings us to, I want to talk about now, after we have hit on these crazy things people do with their taxes, an issue that I've had come up multiple times in the last month talking with clients and potential clients is how to handle wealth and children. And there's a pretty persistent impulse. There's two impulses that parents have that are probably instinctive but wrong. They just lead us to trouble. And the first one is the idea that we can protect children from the evils of inherited wealth by keeping it secret from them. That if somehow if our children don't know that we're rich, that they'll grow up with the same kind of mentality that mom and dad grew up, who grew up in a maybe a situation where they had to pay their own way. They knew that nobody else was gonna pay their way, so they had to get a job and they had to pay for their own schooling and start their own business. And if they were going to have something in life, they were going to do it themselves. People with wealth want their children to have that same kind of mental state, work ethic, I can do it myself attitude. And so they think that if they hide their wealth from their children, that's the kind of attitude that they're going to end up with. And it just doesn't work for a whole bunch of reasons. And maybe it doesn't work because of the second impulse that parents have, which I'll talk about here in a second. But I want to hit this idea that we think if our children know they're going to get money, if they know that they're going to inherit something someday, that it's going to make them lazy, it's going to make them take away their incentives to work, they're just going to hang out waiting for us to die, and they'll never get educated or become productive. And I think that's messed up thinking. I think that, in fact, that's approaching parenting from the idea that, I guess I like to compare it to sex. If we pretend that sex doesn't exist, that our children, when they become teenagers and they have raging hormones, that they'll suddenly make sexually responsible decisions. And that's just crazy. If we pretend it doesn't exist, we don't talk to them about it. We don't introduce values. We don't train or educate them on how to make good decisions, on how to be healthy, and how to avoid dangerous activities. And all of that applies equally with personal sexual decisions as well as it does with financial decisions. The fact is, those topics should be out in the open, upfront, comfortable subject matter at the dinner table. And on the financial end, I want, and this is an observation I make all the time on our show, but there are families who get a little tiny bit of money and it messes them up. And at the same time, there are families that have enormous amounts of wealth and have passed wealth on from generation to generation and consistently turn out highly productive, powerful, effective individuals that are well educated. They produce things. They contribute to their communities, even though they have enormous amounts of wealth. And you don't get that result by accident. You get it on purpose, and you get it by being deliberate. And even things like teaching children how to manage assets, teaching them how to balance a checkbook, how to pay bills, how to fill out their tax forms, how to read a financial statement. And I guess most people don't teach their children how to read a financial statement because they don't know how to read a financial statement. But
that's what I find.
Which, by the way, I'm going to plug something. There's a series of books by Robert Kiyosaki. He started this movement, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. That his very first book, which frankly, as a piece of literature, is substandard. It's awkwardly written, and if you're a person who loves books, it's actually kind of painful to read. But the ideas are just stunning. And as a financial legal professional, I read that book some years ago and thought that I knew how to read financial statements. And he told me things about financial statements that kind of blew my mind, that I was suddenly looking at them with a whole new from a whole new perspective. So I recommend people get that book, figure out there's things on financial statements, your assets and your liabilities, what kind of things go where, and what's the relationship between the two? How do liabilities on your balance sheet affect the results you see on your income statement when you have your income and expenses? That kind of stuff is just really critical for everybody to understand. And if parents don't understand it, there's no way they can teach their children about it. So that, starting with some good books on that, but those kind of things should be open for discussion and should be discussed around the dinner table. I can hear you want to say something, Rich. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I don't know how you heard that. Anyway, I was just thinking that I spend a lot of my time educating people who own businesses, who have owned businesses for years. In fact, I did at Sundance just a week ago, just a little over a week ago, to a group of very successful dental professionals. And, you know, I spent 45 minutes talking about their financial statements. I'd gotten them to send them in to me before this event. And you know, we dropped them into a format that makes some sense, and spent some time going through. And just like you saying about the book that you read, they were blown away. It was, you know, it was just shocking how much dialogue that spawned for the rest of the weekend, about, because suddenly lights went on, and it was like they felt empowered because they could actually tell what was going on in their business. Because if you present the financial information in a particular way, and by the way, QuickBooks doesn't really do a good job of that for you, just in case anybody was wondering, alphabetical order isn't really a good way to list your expenses and really understand what's going on. And that's kind of the default, and that's what I see, you know, like 80% of the time. So it was interesting, and I felt like these people went away thinking, hey, you know what, I really understand how to run my business, or feel like I can really know what's going on just because I actually understand the numbers now. So it's a very important skill. So saying that people need to know that, and that they need to teach their children that, and that if they do, children become, I think, much more responsible with money if they can understand what's happening, because most people that just blow through money is because they just don't get basic concepts.
Well, I'm reminded, I've actually had this conversation a great many times. The 16 or 17 year old who tells you with great he's really proud of himself how he's going to invest his money in a car, and that's almost a bizarre concept. So you're going to invest in a car? Yeah, I'm going to take this, you know, pile of money that I've worked really hard, and I'm going to invest it in a car. And so why is that an investment? And they'll say, well, because I'll have this car, which is really cool, and I'll get really great dates because I got a great car. And then when I'm ready to go to college or go off on a mission or go off on, you know, whatever they're going to go off and do, I'll be able to sell the car and get all the money from the car. Okay, so let's do some math here. Let's do some simple math. How much is the car going to cost you to buy? How much is it going to cost you to insure? How much is it going to cost you to fix it up so it can work after you buy it, because you're going to buy an old clunker or whatever? How much is it going to cost you to maintain? How much is it going to cost you to operate? And they haven't thought through those things. So even the relationship of assets and liabilities to income and expenses, it was a shocking revelation to me. I remember that one of the biggest things that an asset really, if I'm going to list it as an asset on my balance sheet, that is something that has a correlating income item on my income sheet. So an asset is something that pays money to me. If it does not produce an income, it's not an asset. We're going to talk some more about this. We need to go to break now, but I want to hit a little more on these financial statements, and then we're going to come back to what is the second instinctive impulse that parents have that really screws up their kids when it comes to money. We'll talk about that when we come back from break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Social media is growing at an astounding rate. In just virtually 5 short years, we have seen YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter take the world by storm. How do you effectively make social media work for you? Tune in to The Social Universe with host Kurt Wilhelm. We'll show you how to market your business or yourself to get ahead, especially in unstable economic times. We'll also discuss practices that you can apply to increase visibility and revenue as you unlock the mysteries of the social universe. The Social Universe is broadcast live every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
What does a visual workplace mean to you? How does it contribute to operational excellence? And what steps do you take to put it powerfully in place? Listen to The Visual Workplace, Work That Makes Sense, to find out. Each week, Dr. Gwendolyn Galsworth, visual workplace expert and award-winning author, shares tools and strategies to help you make the workplace speak at a glance without saying a word. Learn to work safer, faster, better, and at far less cost, no matter what business you're in. Tune in to The Visual Workplace every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Business.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Okay, before break, welcome back, everybody. Before break, we were talking about dumb things parents do to mess up their kids with money, and one of them is not teaching them about financial statements, but about how to think about money. But that's because parents don't know, and understanding the difference between assets and liabilities. We, on our break, we were talking about a classic one that teenagers get sucked into this. My car is an investment idea. Adults get sucked into this. My house is an investment idea. And we think because we can do a balance sheet and we look at the value of our house in the asset line and its mortgage on the liability line, and because there's some net equity, that hey, that's good, that's an asset. But then we have to look at what's going on the income and expense statement. Does our residence, does it produce any income items on that? And the answer is it does not, not a single one. But it produces lots of expenses. And some of them we'd have to pay anyway, utilities probably. But then there's the broken air conditioner and the broken water heater and the paint and the repair and the maintenance and the taxes and on. That house cost us money to live there and to possess. And what would happen if we stopped paying those things? If we didn't pay our taxes on our house, it would go away. If we didn't pay for all the maintenance on it, its equity, the value would decline. And Rich, you made the point on break again that, our houses used to be appreciating assets. We could buy them at a low value, and over time they'd go up. So they were kind of a pseudo investment. But that's kind of been clobbered in the last 4 or 5 years as property values have taken a big kick in the shorts and gone down in value. My house is is almost worth what I paid for it nearly 13, 14 years ago.
Right.
It went up, but it went way back down, and it's almost back to zero is about how I think about it.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of the way it is in Phoenix right now, is people are back to break even.
So I want to talk about the second instinctive thing that parents do with money that really messes up their kids. And this is so – it's hardwired into us. And this is – it gets expressed in a lot of ways. Sometimes it's the I want my children to have all the things I didn't have, or I want to help my children, or I want to help my children not suffer or have bad things happen to them. So then we use our money, we use our wealth to frankly bail children out of bad choices. And this happens in countless ways. From the little child that one of my favorite examples and that I've used in my article, How to Leave Your Estate to Your Children Without Ruining Them, the small child that has an ice cream cone in their hand and they're kind of wobbling around, and we can watch them and they're at risk of dropping this thing, and we try and say, hey, come on, let's sit down here. Let's sit down while we eat this. If we're standing up while we eat the ice cream, something unhappy is gonna occur here. But the child doesn't listen. So they toddle around and they drop their ice cream cone on the ground. And now they can't eat it. It's garbage. And of course they're upset and they're crying. And what's the impulse of the parent? It's to replace the ice cream cone. And that doesn't really cost us anything significant. It's not going to impair our lifestyle. We don't have to borrow money for that. It's a trivial thing in our minds. Oh, let's just get you a new ice cream cone. There you go. Stop crying now. But what we've taught the child in that situation is that we're going to give them stuff. They can completely ignore our advice. We can tell them to sit down. We can tell them to be careful, and they don't have to listen to us. And when something horrible happens as a result of their bad choices, it doesn't matter. Mom and Dad are going to bail them out. So it's the ice cream cone when they're 3. It's the car when they're 17. It's the house when they're 29. It's the business when they're 35. It's the bad marriage when they're 42. It's all this stuff. And parents over and over and over again bail their kids out and try and pay for things. So I know this. I counsel people on this. I write articles about this, and yet I'm going to just tell a kind of a personal event and story. I have an adult child who's doing very well, paying their own way through school, has no debt, and my impulse as the parent is, oh, I want to help them, and I keep coming up with ideas. I'm going to buy this for them, or I'm going to go pay that for them. And I keep floating these ideas by my wife, who is almost universally much smarter than I am. And she graciously says,
you're a typical man.
Yeah. Don't be an idiot. They're doing fine without you. They don't need your money. If you do that, you're going to mess them up, because the fact is there's a psychological, I don't know, emotional thing that they need that's far more important than anything I could buy them, and that is they need to know they can do it on their own. They need to know that they can make their own money, they can pay their own way, they can support themselves, they don't need me. If they make a mistake, they can recover. If they have a loss, they can recover. If a bad thing happens, if their car breaks, they lose their lease and have to move from their home, if their employment changes, it's okay. They're going to be all right. They're going to recover. And my impulse to, well, I have the ability to help them, why don't I just pitch in and help them here? That impulse is, I think, universal. And it's not just men. I don't think it's a gender thing. It's in my household.
What I meant by that, Rick, was that your wife is smarter than you are.
Well, yeah.
I'm going to say you're a typical man. So, 'cause most wives are.
There's no question that she's smarter than I am. That's anybody who knows us knows that, especially my children know that. But I do see moms have often have this impulse to I don't want my children to suffer. And they can say, you know, dear, pull out the checkbook and let's take care of them. Let's help them with their rent, or let's get them a car, or let's pay for this, or let's pay for that. And it's a mistake. It's just flat out, it's the wrong thing to do. And does that mean we don't help our kids? No, we do help our kids. And have I helped my kids financially? Yeah. But we have to be really, really cautious. And I guess let me quote Baden-Powell here, since I love scouting and have done a lot on that. Baden-Powell, one of his statements about leadership and boys, he said, never do for a boy anything the boy can do for themselves. And his point was, if the boy, you know, in a scouting situation, if the boy has the ability to set up their own tent and put up their own sleeping bag and cook their own dinner, they should. They need to do that. If we intervene, oh, let me help you set that tent up. Oh, let me help you get that fire started. Oh, let me help you cook that dinner. Then the boy's going to stand there and watch us do it because we can do it. And they're going to learn, hey, this is a good deal. I can feign incompetent, and the adult will, who's been hovering over me, will intervene and will take over and will do the work, and I can watch. I don't have to do anything. And children get this, and they will respond to us in the way we've trained them with money. If they learn at three, hey, I can throw my ice cream on the floor and watch. Mom gives me another one. Score! Multiply that, extrapolate that out to when they're 14 or 20 or 30 or whatever, it just becomes a disaster. So don't bail our kids out. The idea that we can use our money to bail our kids out of bad choices is just flat wrong. And kind of now let's tie these two together. Kids don't have financial literacy because their parents feel awkward or embarrassed about talking about it because they want to keep it secret, or they don't possess personally the knowledge to intelligently talk about financial statements at the dinner table. So let's just be quiet about it and pretend like it doesn't exist. And then when the children start to mess up, we want to use our money to bail them out. And I think something important for us all to consider is this idea that we have choices. And this is political theory or perhaps spiritual theory, the notion that we have choices, that we get to choose what we're going to do with our life. We can choose what we're going to do with our money. We can choose what we're going to do with our families. And often the choices are made tougher because we don't know what they are. So if we can ask ourselves and we can ask our children, what are my choices here? Do you know what your choices are? I think that's one of the most powerful questions you can ask a 15-year-old who's saying, well, can I do this? Well, do you know what your choices are? What are your options here? Help them think through that. If we can think through, what are my options financially? What are my options with my house? What are my options with my job? What are my options with my ability to raise money? What are my options with my estate, with my business, with my retirement? What are my options? When we know what our options are and we can look at those and ask ourselves, then, well, what's good and bad about each of those various options, then we can make better choices. I want to hit one more topic here. We've got to wrap up, but I want to give a pitch to something that makes a big, huge difference. When we look at families that over multiple generations have a successful relationship with wealth, who have a healthy relationship with it, it's a positive influence in their lives. It's a beneficial influence in the lives of their children. They're productive and effective. What are some factors that we can identify in the lives of people who live that way? And one of the biggest and most conspicuous is that people who live well and who do well with wealth have a deliberate, a direct, and vigorous commitment to giving to charity. They give to charities a lot, and it's not always open. They're not always, in fact, the better ones, in my opinion, are not seeking for to have their name on the building or getting credit or public acclaim for it. They do it privately and quietly. But when you're looking on their financial statements on the back end or in their legal planning on the back end, quietly, privately, they just give away a lot of money. And
that seems so backwards to many people, Rick, and then thinking, well, man, you know, they give all this money away, then you know, they're not going to have any left. But it doesn't ever seem to work that way. And
you know, yeah, I think it's part of the psychology, the scarcity mentality. Oh, I can't give any away because this is all I have, and I don't know if I'm ever going to get any more. That kind of thought process results in you not getting any more. You think you're not going to get any more, so you don't. But the thought process that, hey, I made this, I can make more. This charity here needs help, so I'm gonna give to them. The idea that our children are our charity too, kind of. Well, yeah, I give to charity. I give to my kids. Don't do that. That messes them up. And even though I'm saying, yeah, don't use your money to bail your children out of poor decisions, I think socially and spiritually, using our whatever wealth we've been blessed with, whatever amount that is, a lot or a little, using that wealth to lighten the load of others around us, to help people in need. And, you know, we've in the news today, we have this terrible events going on. Use your money to do good in the world around you, and that will be a blessing to your children. So give us a call, 480-324-8000. Email us at info@whataboutwealth.com. We'd love to hear from you. It's been a pleasure to visit with you today on the day after tax day, and we'll be back next week.
For listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.